At that time, in 1862, there were only 13 colleges in the United States at which you could study engineering. And two of those were West Point and Annapolis. There were a very limited, perhaps no more than at any given time, 300 to 500 students in the entire United States studying engineering. And perhaps, and it's very difficult to count this, but historians say that there were about 1,000 people in the United States who made their living as engineers in 1860. In the wake of the Morrill Land Grant Act, engineering exploded in the United States. By 1917, there were 126 engineering colleges in which 30,000 students were enrolled. Between 1860 and 1960, the number of engineers in the United States doubled every single decade, and then it doubled again between 1960 and 1980. The rate slowed down by half, so it doubled in 20 years instead of 10, so that in the 1980s, there were 2 million engineers in the United States. It was the largest profession for males in the United States. Furthermore, so that's engineering, not science, but furthermore, there was a battle in the 19th century as these engineering colleges were being created and about as rapidly as they could be built in that last 20 years, going from 13 to 126 in a period of 40 years or so. There was a battle over what the basis of engineering education should be. On the one side were those conservative forces that thought of engineers as highly skilled machinists and that engineering education should be based on the workshop. The victory, and it was not an easy one, went to those people who said that engineering must be based on science, that engineering students must learn physics, chemistry, math, and work in the laboratory, not the workshop. Workshop, okay, but the core of engineering education has to be math, physics, chemistry, and laboratory studies, because engineering has to be able to transfer science to industry. This is the battle. That was the battle. And the victory went to that particular model. But that meant that we needed a lot of physicists, chemists, and mathematicians, which we did not need before in this country. We needed thousands of them to be faculty at the hundreds of engineering colleges that were now being built after the Morrill Land Grant Act, 126 by 1917. At the present moment, there are over 200. So this created a community of academic physicists, chemists, and mathematicians at exactly the time that American universities adopted a whole new model for their faculty's performance, especially with the creation of Johns Hopkins University shortly after the Civil War, which was the first American university to give a doctorate. And in the 1890s, with the creation of the University of Chicago, where research was explicitly a requirement for faculty, was a job requirement for faculty, the university became a place where faculty were expected to create new knowledge. This was a 19th century innovation that had not been the case before. This was not the case for the teachers of history and classics and literature and language, etc. They were expected to teach the history that we had inherited, the knowledge we had inherited. Now it became the critical role of the university to create new knowledge. And so the impact on science was very dramatic. Now we had a large community of scientists who were explicitly being pushed in the direction of doing research. Now we are into the first two decades of the 20th century. That's why there was an American physics community in the 20th century, I believe, largely because those people were needed to service the engineering education. But of course, a kind of a positive feedback loop sets in which you have to create physics major, you have to create physics curricula and chemistry curricula and math curricula, if only to get the faculty, but then you wind up with more people who need jobs beside that. But that's all right, because the pull here was industry. Industry was soaking up all of these engineering people because American industry was developing at an extraordinarily rapid rate, and it was what we would call today high-tech industry. That is to say, we're talking about the electrical industry, the electronics industry, the aircraft industry, the automotive industry, and telecommunications industries. So this was the pull. And the commercial value of knowledge of chemistry, especially, and increasingly of physics and mathematics, was being recognized. But it was still a no-no to use public funds to support basic research for these academic scientists. Universities want to have departments of physics. That's their business. If they want to require original research, that's their business. The money's not going to come from the federal government.